Good morning, everyone. Cue the Masterpiece Theater music now, please. Welcome to this inaugural event, this McGill Leadership Summit. And this session is entitled Healing Our World, Promoting Global Health and Well-Being. I'm Richard Levin, the Vice Principal for Health Affairs and the Dean of the Faculty of Medicine. I'm joined by a fantastic panel whom I'm pleased to introduce in just a few moments. The format for our conversation this morning, and it will be a conversation with you as the audience, will consist of a series of brief introductions by our three experts on their areas of specialization, which will be a means of getting into this incredibly important topic. What is the topic? What can you expect of these 90 minutes? Well, we heard a few moments ago from Janine Schmidt that the word transformative is used much too much now. It's merely a cliche. But I promise you these 90 minutes will change your thinking, especially those of you who are nationalists. You will lose your nationalism after these 90 minutes. I want to begin in Elizabethan England, where things were advancing rapidly, and England was conquering as much of the known world as they possibly could. There was a brief excursion to Cadiz in Spain, the most important port of Spain at the time. And Sir Walter Raleigh was there and had with him a poet, a clergyman who enjoyed travel. His name was John Donne, and he was influenced in a great way by William Shakespeare. And he said in a meditation, "No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. Any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind, and therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee." Late 17th century, he couldn't possibly have known what was to follow, but he sounded the bell. He said, "We are connected in ways that make us one." He could not have known that a new illness, ultimately named SARS, would travel around the world in less than a week and infect distant places, change Toronto permanently, the healthcare system there, the involvement of nurses in hospitals in particular, has not gone back to the way it was. It is the age in which we live. I was on a tour of the United States, meeting alumni, some of you in this room, and met a man named John Corafus Smart, who got an MD-CM degree in 1944 and a diploma in tropical medicine in 1945, and happened to be the first foreign minister of Sierra Leone after it was freed from British rule. A remarkable 90-plus-year-old gentleman who wants the Gates Foundation to eradicate poverty, which will eradicate illness by increasing the literacy rate in African nations to 100%, has decided that that is the single thing that could modify the outcome in that continent. And all of these issues, new diseases, epidemics, pandemics, literacy rate, poverty, are related in an extraordinary way to the third topic of the morning, which is our environment and the fact that our children are at risk for a world which we cannot imagine, in which the ocean level will rise, the continents will be reconfigured, and no one has a clue how we will deal with the chaos that ensues from that event. So we are challenged by an Elizabethan clergyman to think about the fact that we are one. And that's the actual topic for this morning's conversation. I would like to introduce, to begin this conversation, our three panelists, distinguished members of the faculty of McGill. First, Jody Heyman, a professor in the faculties of both medicine and the arts. She is the founding director of both the McGill Institute for Health and Social Policy and the Harvard-based Project on Global Working Families. She is an advocate for the poor throughout the world and has advised international organizations, including UNESCO and the World Health Organization. Her 2006 book, Forgotten Families, presents the results of interviews with more than 55,000 families across five continents. And her work on looking at the secular databases, the descriptions of laws and facts about work conditions in all of the countries of the United Nations, have and will have a dramatic effect on our world. Please join me in welcoming Professor Jody Heyman. Professor Nigel Roulet is the James McGill Professor of Geography and a former director of the McGill School of Environment, contributed to the 2007 report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, an organization that, with Al Gore, won the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize. He's an expert on the importance of northern wetlands and forests in the Earth's carbon cycle, among many other issues, and is an expert on greenhouse gases and the effect that they're having and could have on our world. Please welcome Professor Roulet. And Brian Ward, who is a real doc, and is an expert on infectious diseases and vaccines, including vaccine development and implementation, and the myths and realities of adverse reactions following vaccination. He was a Rhodes Scholar, received his medical training at McGill, Oxford, Johns Hopkins, and the University of London. He is now Chief of Infectious Diseases at the MUHC and Associate Director of the McGill Center for Tropical Diseases. Let's greet Dr. Ward. So I'd like to get into it right off and ask Jody to make her introductory remarks, and in sequence our other two panelists, and then directed by their remarks, we will have a conversation about how we can save the world. Jody.
Pretty tall order. I'm hoping in the discussion afterwards you're going to be giving us the answers to that, but it's an enormous pleasure to be here with you all. As a policy researcher and as an advisor to governments and to the UN, my training and my job is to think about the world and to think about the health of populations. But as a physician, I was trained to think about individuals. And that kind of thinking grounds you. So I hope in these few minutes of introduction today, I'll do a little bit of both. I'll talk about our global efforts, but I'll do it by telling you about three families around the world in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and what we hope to do for them. But before I start, I actually have a question for you all that's coming up in a minute. I assume you, like I did, got this little goodie bag. And I noticed when I opened it up for my tickets that McGill was teaching me how to do effective hand washing, which I was very surprised about. Please, some great H1N1 flu prevention. Now, In addition to effective hand washing, wherever you are in the world, whether you're listening to Harper, to Obama, to the World Health Organization, they'll all tell you to stay home when you get sick. That's so you don't spread it to everybody else. So my first question for you, and in a minute you're going to see the relevance of this, I promise. But my first question for you, raise your hands. How many of you could stay home when you get sick? I'm not saying you would. I realize many people would go to work. But how many would have the option of staying home when they get sick? Okay, almost everybody here. Now, how many of you, if you had a loved one you needed to care for who was sick, because you're also recommended that if your children are sick, stay home with them, keep them home. If you have an older family member who needs help, keep them home. How many of you, again, I'm not going to press you on whether you would do that for this family member, but could you do that? Could you stay home? Again, almost everybody here could do that. Now our three families. The first is a woman I met in Vietnam. Phong Dien Nguyen worked in a shoe factory. She gave birth to a child with severe disabilities. At first, Leap seemed like he was a healthy child, but then he rapidly started to have frequent seizures, developmental delay, and he had a lot of disabilities that were probably related to the birth and their poverty and the lack of care she had both before and during the delivery. Now, Pham was not as lucky as us. She needed to stay home, not just for the flu, which is spreading around the world and where she and many millions of others will need to stay home, but she needed to stay home because her child had serious illnesses that she had to attend to whenever they hit him, and she had to bring him to physicians. But every time she stayed home, she lost pay. And the problem was she didn't just lose one day pay. For every day lost, she lost 3 days pay. So she was rapidly going into basically indentured servitude with this job with the number of days she missed. That's the first family I want you to keep in mind. The second is Ramon and his sister Liliana. I'm a pediatrician by training. I met Ramon in Honduras in these barracks that had been built after Hurricane Mitch. Anybody who's been to the capital of Honduras, Tegucigalpa, I'll show hands for this, but there are probably not as many of us who have been to Tegucigalpa. Okay, no other hands on this one, so I'm going to describe it. It's basically, it's on a cliffside. It's on an escarpment, and so you couldn't create a capital where more houses, again, the poor live on the highest parts of the escarpment in shacks that are put together with limited resources, and they all came down during the mudslides that followed this hurricane. So they were living in shacks afterwards, and when I met Ramon, who was 11, he was caring for his 5 siblings under 5, including Liliana, who sat so still that she didn't move. I couldn't see eyes move, anything move. Severely malnourished, no child care for her. Short story, because we have just a few minutes. His parents needed to work 12-hour days, both of them, in order to rebuild. No care available for kids under 5. He was pulled out of school. It was his second year pulled out of school, and he was starting to fail further and further, and he was just incapable of getting an education himself and of caring for these younger siblings. Third family, Botswana, Karang, caring for her own children and her brother's children because her brother had died of AIDS, as had his wife. She was pregnant. Country had no maternity leave. She had to choose whether to go right back to her job, but they needed her income. Their family had more than doubled. They had many mouths to feed. And when I met her, her daughter, Zita, was visibly malnourished, half the size she should have been, because of the need to early return to work. And in a setting where breastfeeding was essential to survival, where it multiplies survival 3 to 5 times. So we knew each of these kids faced terrible odds if we did nothing. Ramon out of school, Liliana totally malnourished by 1.5, Zita on the road to malnutrition, and Leap cared for when he could in a family that was falling greater and more deeply into poverty. And the question was, can we do anything about this, all of us together as a global community, and can we do anything as a university? So I want to very quickly, to save more of it for discussion, do two things. Tell you what we have done for each and answer, are we having any success? So what have we done about sick leave? We did the first global study to look at the extent to which it is actually a problem for people to be able to care for their own health while they're working or the health of loved ones. We looked at what approaches countries around the world, 190 out of 192 UN nations are taking, and I just got back from the South Pacific so we can fill in the last two island states. And we looked at where these approaches were economically viable. Could countries compete while they were doing it? And what was the health impact? And found out what works. Found out about policies that actually lower death rates, lower mortality from illness, above and beyond what health insurance does. We did a parallel study for maternity leave, looked at how it's constructed around the world, looked at who has it, and looked at the impact on infant mortality. These are the kinds of work that McGill is uniquely well situated to do. I think I can say that because I've had the privilege of being at other wonderful universities. Up till 4 years ago, I ran this program that the 11 mentioned at Harvard, which is another great university. But I have never been at a place that has the ability to collaborate across faculties, across law, medicine, arts, science, dentistry, music, every faculty here, religious studies, in the way that these big social problems absolutely demand. Are we having any success? And that's where I want to end, because we promised most of the time for conversation. In sick leave, we're beginning to have success. I didn't mention one of our global neighbors to the south, the United States, is one of the few countries in the world with absolutely no sick leave, with half the population not having it, with it dramatically affecting health outcomes. We've led to legislation being passed in California for 50 million Americans, new legislation under consideration nationally. I've met with heads of state from around the world at a meeting that Gordon Brown held that we presented what could be done around sick leave to both the heads of state from these 14 countries and from their top ministers for many more. On maternity leave, next month we're going to have a release that's global, but including a special release in Africa, because 4 of the 5 countries that haven't addressed maternity leave outside of the United States are in Africa. On childcare, I'll be meeting with leaders from around the world that are coming together under UNICEF's auspices in London again next month to try to work on how the global economy is affecting early education in these early years and other pieces of children's outcomes. These are just beginnings, they're starts. Ultimately, we'll only be able to measure our success when I can go back to FOM, to Ramon, and Kring, and be able to say that the fact that they voiced their concerns meant that together with them we could do something about it. So we look forward to the chance to hear your ideas and to learn how we can all work together on these problems. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jody. So we'll move from health and social policy to the environment and ask Nigel to give us his introduction.
Well, thank you very much for coming. It's a pleasure to do this. I've done a number of these. I'm not going to give you a talk on climate change. I'm actually doing that in a couple of weeks in one of the mini lecture series that Cappy organizes. But what I thought I'd talk about in the kind of context of this is in a very few minutes lay out the issue that we have to deal with, and then give you an example of, through my research and my involvement research, one way that I think is not the way to approach the problem, and another way that actually might hold some hope in the way that we can approach the problem. Most of you have heard about climate change. Most of you read about it every day in the newspaper. You think about it. There's a few things I'd like just to put in context, though, for most people don't understand. Climate change is an issue that is occurring now. If we were to stop our emissions into the atmosphere instantaneously now and take them to zero, we will still be dealing with this problem in 200 years because of the legacy effect of how long it takes to get the excess carbon out of the atmosphere. So that's one issue that we're dealing with, is a massive legacy effect. The second issue that you deal with in global climate change is it does not belong to any nation or any country. It is truly a global phenomenon that is occurring. It'll occur in different and affect people in different areas, and this is where the three members of the panel have something in common, in the sense that we don't experience climate. What we experience is weather. You don't get up in the morning, you go, and you say, oh, there's been a 2% change in precipitation in the long-term mean in Montreal, so therefore I'm going to take my umbrella to work. What you do is you get up and you say, oh, the weatherman says it's going to rain by noon, so therefore I'm going to take my umbrella to work. That's the contact that you have with climate, is actually its day-to-day manifestation. That's the contact that we see when we're dealing with issues of where people are living in the world, how they produce their crops, how they produce their food, the water supplies they have, and these various different things. What climate change will do to those is change the dynamics of the way weather provides those types of things, the habitats for organisms, the geographical space that they work in, and things like this. And that's where the dimension comes in, where it really has an impact in humans, is changing this thing that we are used to, which is the weather patterns that we're highly adapted to. We now know, it's very clear, I work on a project that's called the Global Carbon Project, that all the estimates that we have done over the last three rounds of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change I've been on are actually very conservative estimates. The rate of increase of CO2 in the atmosphere, we did not anticipate it increasing at the rate it is increasing now, because we did not anticipate the economies of India and China coming on as quickly as they have. If you look at any of the reports that we produce, the CO2 in the atmosphere should be 378 parts per million today, and it's actually 387 parts per million today, and it's going up in an exponential increase in the way that is happening at the present time. So this problem is a serious problem. How do we actually deal with this? In the sense that you're all hearing in the press about people heading or getting ready to head to Copenhagen for the 15th session of the Conference of Parties to the United Nations Framework on Climate Change. You all have heard about Kyoto Protocol. We agreed, meaning the industrialized nations agreed, over the last 10 years that we would reduce our greenhouse gas emissions to 6% below their 1990 levels. Does anybody want to guess where those emissions are actually now? They're not 6% below, they're on average 27% higher. The Kyoto Protocol, as an international agreement, has raised debate over this year, but it's being over this issue, but as being an effective tool to actually evoke change, it has been a total failure. And we are now in the process of negotiating, or the pre-meetings to go towards Copenhagen, which by everything that you read in the newspapers and the things that I hear in the back rooms, is going to be a total failure also in the sense of arriving at an agreement. So we've tried this large-scale, international type of agreement, problems with the governance structures and how we would do this. The opposite side of this is something that has been absolutely thrilling that I've got involved in because of my research position here at McGill, is, and I'm not really sure why this came about, but the Premier of Ontario, over a year and a half ago, said he recognized the importance of Canada's largest ecosystem, which is called the boreal forest, and how important it is in biological diversity, ecological services, and regulating the climate. It is very important in regulating the climate. It is one of the single may be the single largest or close to the largest carbon pool in the soils and in the trees. And it's extremely important for regulating distribution of snow and these various different things that are very important for the reflectivity of the climate. And he said, we need to be able to preserve the ecological integrity of this landscape. So they put on the table, it's been tabled, it's a bill that's gone through the first reading in the Ontario legislature. It's called the Far North Protection Act. And what the Ontario has said is that they have put in legislation that will protect 51% of the boreal forests north of 51 degrees north. Now, I'm sure all of you took your geography class, and you can immediately know how much that is. It actually is 5,000 square kilometers of boreal forest that is to be protected. And in that legislation, they stated specifically the reason why any development that's going to occur in that area has to, A, not reduce the ecological integrity of that landscape, B, not diminish the biodiversity, and C, not alter the climate regulation. This is coming from completely opposite end of the scales of governance that the province is taking this initiative. Now, the thing that's very exciting as a scientist is that these are things that we have always argued for from the scientific community as what is really boots on the ground types of things that you need to put into legislation to have to be effective in offsetting some of these global changes that we're seeing. The scary thing as a scientist now is that someone actually listened to us, has put this into legislation, and then calls you up and says, I would like you, of one of 11 experts, to tell me how do I measure ecological integrity of the landscape, and how do I develop a metric to know when somebody wants to develop something in the boreal forest region, how is that going to diminish or enhance the climate regulation that we have written into this legislation? So they've written into the legislation exactly what the scientific community wanted in that legislation, and now as a community we have to belly up to the bar and say, okay, this is actually how you implement it, which is very interesting because as a scientist, we're not very well trained to deal with this policy arena. And so we're dealing with constantly every month with about 40 people that are at Queen's Park that are on the policy side, the legislative side, on how to enact that. So I think at the local level, there are some really good examples of what are happening in how we might resolve some of these problems, whereas at the international level, we seem to be kind of going the opposite direction to the way that we should be.
So poverty and its consequences, the environment, and now illness.
So as often happens when your last name ends with or begins with W, you end up speaking third or last, and some of the things that you were planning on saying go out the window based on what's been said before. So I'll just start by saying that, but two small anecdotes. One is that about 4.5 weeks ago, a group of scientific experts from across the country were collected in Toronto, the Toronto Airport Sheraton Hotel, in a meeting room in the basement, paid for by the government. And we were there because we're part of the Pandemic Vaccine Task Group, a group of academic and public health scientists giving advice to the government. And it was a fairly tense meeting, but during the, this was for H1N1, vaccine development, and towards the end of the meeting, the whole building actually started to shake, and we all went to the very small window that was available to us, and we saw a tornado or two, the storm that was spawning the tornadoes that hit southern Ontario, and it occurred to me that one of the things about having a multidisciplinary panel and knowing people who do other things was that one thing that occurred to me as I was watching this really ferocious storm come through the Toronto airport was, one, I'm glad I'm not flying, and two, this is Nigel's fault. So at least you have some place to place the blame. The other thing, given what Nigel just said, was that these negotiations that we've been having between the academic and the public health and regulatory community in Canada over H1N1 vaccines is a very interesting one and has resulted in a number of quite difficult standoffs where we have been told in no uncertain terms that as academics we are quite welcome to give advice. It does not necessarily follow that the governments will take said advice, and that we've been fairly roughly put in our place on a number of occasions for a variety of reasons. I do a lot of work in the area of vaccines, and I do the work both nationally and internationally, and so I'm going to focus my comments mostly on vaccines because my wife calls me relentlessly optimistic in the area of health, and a number of sessions like this, in speaking to people afterwards, they've come up to me and other panel members and said, what a bummer. This is, you know, we come out of these sessions and we feel horrible that all of these terrible things are happening and are inevitable. And that's perhaps true. These horrible things may well be happening and some of them may be inevitable. But I think in the area of health, certainly there is also reason for considerable optimism in what the new technologies and the new willingness to address these issues can bring for all of us, both locally and internationally. Vaccines is a particularly optimistic area, I think, for a variety of reasons, not least of which is the recent recognition that vaccines are no longer the poor sisters of the pharmaceutical industry. Vaccines are now recognized as blockbuster products. The reason why one major corporation would actually buy a second major corporation to get their vaccine pipeline. That just occurred with Pfizer's acquisition of Wyeth. That's never happened in the history of the pharma industry, that vaccines are now seen by the pharmaceutical company as a source of great importance for their survival. And that is actually a very good thing for the rest of us because there's a great deal of expertise in those large pharmaceutical corporations and in the interactions between those corporations and the benevolent societies and foundations that have stood up and said, hey guys, vaccines are important. The Bill and Melinda Gates Vaccine Fund being one of the most important and the Gates Foundation being one of the most important. We have arrived at a point in the last 5 years, really, where you have some political will, you have enormous resources being put into the area of vaccine development by Gates Foundation and major international institutions as well as governments, and you also have the pharmaceutical manufacturers that are capable of doing these things and bringing them to the world. The plagues that the Dean Levin alluded to at the beginning, SARS was a tiny little one. Smallpox was a bigger one. When I entered medical school in 1975, many of the lecturers in the area of infectious diseases referred to infectious diseases in the past tense. We've controlled these. We are in control. We have established our dominance over the world of microbes. I think that that now, since in the last 20, 30 years, we've seen HIV, an agent that is continuing to change the world, just as smallpox changed the world and measles changed the world before it. We've seen West Nile arrive. We've seen SARS. We've seen completely new organisms that explain things like hepatocellular carcinoma. We now know that's caused by hepatitis B. We now know that all cervical cancer virtually is caused by human papillomavirus. Well, it is enormously hopeful that we have vaccines that can prevent those cancers. They are the first anti-cancer vaccines. So the upside is that the application of science to these enormous global problems is right at our fingertips. We can do this. We can provide the care. We can develop new vaccines. We have the tools now to develop vaccines for malaria, for tuberculosis, probably for HIV, hepatitis C. We will do this in the next 10 years. However, one of the things we must do is we must make sure that it doesn't take 10 to 20 years for the vaccines that we develop for us to get to the poorest places on Earth. That can no longer happen. The average delay between the initiation of a universal vaccination program in rich countries and more or less universal access in poor countries is between 15 and 18 years currently. That's obviously completely unacceptable. So we have enormous hope. I have enormous hope that for many of these infectious diseases that are one of the root causes of the poverty that we see all over the world will be addressed in the next decade. However, we have to marshal the political will and the resources to actually make sure that they are translated into the field. We also have to acknowledge that that Nigel's tornadoes and hurricanes and floods and mudslides, all of them really his fault at one level, are along with man-made disasters, the reason why many of these countries cannot control these infectious processes. And since, as Dean Levin said, we are literally one airline flight away from having any disease anywhere in the world arrive on our doorstep the next day, what happens in Tegucigalpa, what happens in Kofifi, is really literally at our doorstep. We are in a very, very small world. So while I am enormously hopeful, and McGill is uniquely positioned, I think, to address some of the issues of infectious diseases, the new plagues, new vaccines, new therapies, I think that we need to be working on all fronts, on poverty, education, environment, to make sure that we will be able to translate these discoveries into the developing world, the medium developed world. We need to make them affordable to the entire world. I'll stop there.
Three different acute perspectives on the problems of the world that are related all through the notion that any man's death diminishes me. And the notion that we are one world in health and medicine is apparent in many ways. And it's interesting that we meet here at a university because I think one of the solutions to the set of problems we are discussing this morning is teaching, is education, because we have such a difficult job of translating what these three investigators have discovered and a host of others into action. To fight superstition, the reaction of parents against the vaccination of their children who are at risk for the H1N1 virus is quite remarkable. This is the 21st century, the century of biology. We have moved very far in time from, theoretically, the superstitions of the past, and yet only 40% of Americans are very interested in having their children vaccinated against this disease. Why is that? Why is there such a sense of mistrust? How do noted experts in their fields capture the attention of society and government in order to be able to do some things? And the challenges that these three have presented are enormous to do some things to change the outcomes in these areas, which are all interrelated. So, assuming that we've piqued your interest and appetite a bit, how about some questions or comments? Because there are experts I see in the audience as well. Yes, in the back. Would you identify yourself and then ask your question?
Josh Washington. They treated a wonderful scientific discussion here. And unfortunately, this is not what the public often hears. And the vaccinations or the public is hearing now, as you just mentioned, is tragic. And they are acting on it. We're a situation here where people like Jed McCarthy and Jim Carrey in the United States hold or gather more attention and hold more weight than the scientific community. And I think the scientific community is a little bit at fault. I think we're not attacking the problem vigorously enough. We're not engaging them in debates. Very often, just letting them run loose. They appear on the major talk shows in the U.S. With just cursory opposition. I think the right-wing movement in the U.S. has been extremely strong in terms of getting their word out against vaccination and against climate change. Climate change faces the same kind of problem. We have the global warming deniers, and I don't think that they are being vigorously enough challenged on their views. I think this is a challenge to us in the scientific community to get out there and try to do some more work on this and try to counter the silliness that is promoted by people like Jenny McCarthy, who speak emotionally, speak very well, and unfortunately in the public domain, emotion trumps science. So just to hear the comments like how I found it, just to engage in that. Just one more comment I'll mention is just the seriousness of this. All of it with this stress of being vaccine promoter in the U.S. with a wonderful book science has to go around with a bodyguard because he is threatened because of his use on vaccines.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, sir.
Sure. It's interesting hearing someone comment in the climate community that we haven't been vigorous in actually taking on the climate deniers. I was on three rounds of the IPCC starting in 1995, 2000, and this last one, 2007, that came out. The amount of time that I spent actually in public debates with the climate deniers was astronomical. In fact, once you get involved in this process, it actually does have a negative effect on the very research that you're trying to do and the reason why you were selected to be on it, just because of the time consumption that happened. I think one of the issues that's very interesting about this, and the difference, if you remember back to February 2007, that is when the fourth report, the fourth scientific assessment was published. The day that it came out, it was released at 9 o'clock in Paris in the morning. I was involved with the press for about a full 48 hours after that. The two previous reports that came out, no one ever called me. I never heard anything about this. The swing between those two things that happened, between those two times. And the tenor at which the press reported on that report coming out had turned 180 degrees from being, well, there are those people that disagree with what the scientists are saying on climate change, or there are scientists themselves that disagree with what scientists are saying, turned around and basically said, well, the press accepted the arguments that were put forward, agreed with the consensus that happened. Now, why did that transformation happen? I don't think that transformation happened at all, because I had spent, and all my colleagues in the IPCC have spent so much time over the last 15 years arguing. I think it was one central event that happened in the United States, which was called Katrina, that devastated the city in the United States. And finally, people looked at it and said, this is the extent to which we can be affected by nature. In the climate community, we were very, very quick to say that Katrina, or at least we would not be able to establish at least for 50 years whether Katrina actually had any of its origin in climate change or global warming. And statistically, you'd have to build up an awful long time to figure out that. It was consistent with it, but no one argued that, for example, that was actually caused by global warming.
except for the press totally ignored all the scientists saying that and attributed it 100% to global warming. And that single act was probably the best thing that ever happened to us being able to convince and the acceptance of the report that came out. The one other event that is happening now that I think is the canary that is making people think about it is the rapid diminishing of the sea ice in the north. Because we now have a satellite technology that you can go on and in your evening news, for the last 3 years, every September and October, you had this almost daily update about, is this going to be the year of the lowest coverage of sea ice that we've seen in such a period of time? And it has political issues, overtones in Canada for sovereignty issues and for issues of shipping in the Lancaster Sound and the environment. Those are the two things, I think, that have really, from a Canadian perspective and also from in the United States, have really tipped the balance for people actually listening to those our arguments that we're putting forward. Yeah, there's still contrarians out there, but they have almost completely disappeared out of the press. We now have the arguments happening, not about climate change, but whether we can actually afford to deal with climate change. The economic consequences of dealing with climate change are just too large. But I would turn around and say the economic consequences of not dealing with climate change are even larger.
Just very briefly, my facetious response to your question is that, and I've actually suggested this to a number of newspaper reporters, is that we start creating a list of all of the vaccine deniers and simply suggest to them that they move to the back of the line in the event of a real pandemic that's killing lots of people. Nobody's taken me up on that yet, but there would be a certain amount of satisfaction in doing that. Nope, not you, back of the line. The less facetious argument is that a number of us, like Nigel, have been working very hard to address the issues of vaccine safety, for example, in every forum offered to us. I gave 10 days of my year 2 summers ago to the class action suit in the United States. So I was one of the major witnesses for the government in the U.S. against the MMR autism and thimerosal autism hypothesis, which was a $15.7 billion lawsuit. That pulled in experts from across the world, from the UK, from France, from Ireland, the United States, and Canada. McGill was actually very well represented there. There were 3 faculty from McGill who testified before that hearing. And it was actually enormously gratifying to all of us who were testifying against these spurious hypotheses that the special masters, 2 years later, produced their report and said, in the most scathing judgment yet, they said that to believe the expert witnesses on the side of the plaintiffs, one would have to, like the Red Queen in Alice in Wonderland, believe 3 highly improbable events before breakfast. That is actually, I think, the only way that we can do this is through sort of piecemeal communication and stepping up to the challenges of the anti-vaccine forces and the environment deniers every opportunity we get, and to not fight emotion with emotion, but fight emotion with science and logic. And eventually we'll win. We'll lose an occasional battle, but eventually we will win, just as we are, I think we're winning the evolution argument, notwithstanding some counties that are still trying to bring back creation scientists into the classroom.
Yeah. Jody, anything to add at this point?
The one thing I want to add is around training. All of these challenges, the remarkable news is we are making incredible progress on them. I mean, I wouldn't have thought it was possible. I was at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard when people 20 years ago started to talk about climate change, and it looked impossible to get attention. We've heard this story on vaccines. I can tell you the same in terms of poverty reduction in a number of countries where we're making remarkable progress. At the same time, there is no doubt for those of us who either have a few gray hairs or should by our age, that this is going to be a problem that still exists. We need the next generation to fight it with us. And I think there's enormous hope there as well in our ability to train better. We have at McGill training programs where our students are getting experience with the media, experience with policymakers. That doesn't happen automatically because you know the facts. The facts alone aren't enough to figure out how to move somebody in government. They're not enough to learn how to move somebody in a UN agency or your own local government, let alone someone else's local government halfway around the world. And I have immense optimism for the number of students who I see at the beginning of the year with no idea and at the end of the year saying, this completely changed how I think about these global issues.
Bill Clinton, who's to receive an honorary doctorate from McGill tomorrow, said that in global health there is no us and them. We are all them. We are all prone to the same conditions. And yet, in the question that Joe asked, we automatically establish an us and them. The us in this case is those that have data and have an understanding about the significance of getting that data to a few more percent of the people of the world or the governments of the world and have them act on these matters. And we'll come back to the issue of the legacy of carbon emissions lasting 200 years. Which is an incredibly frightening prospect. But I think there are other questions. Sir?
Nick Rivera, a physician. Can I just go back, because we're to come out of this, I think, with, you know, we're hearing some great lectures, many lectures, stimulating lectures from our professors. But we're also to come back and try to stimulate beyond Montreal why people should think of McGill when it comes to contributing. And I'd like you to amplify what is special about McGill. One of them is there's a sense of a global mission. People come to McGill, at least some of them, certainly some of the professors, think beyond Montreal and Quebec and Canada. I heard from Jody a little bit about once you have decided what the message is, you need to be taught how to tell the message to deal with opponents, but could you amplify as a group what is special about McGill versus another university in Canada or North America? Why should we think about McGill in a special way?
So I'm sure that the group is ready to jump on this, but we have an audience that can answer that question. And I would like to engage you, deans, faculty, alumni. What is special about McGill? Why is it relevant in the 21st century, as it has been for almost 200 years?
My name is Bernard Shapiro, but I would say that one of the things that is different about McGill, it's not unique, it's not the most distinctive unique institution in the world, but I think one of the things that is special, or two things has been mentioned before by the panel, which is the relative ease that's been at McGill to get to people, to get individuals to work across faculty and across departmental lines. That is very difficult in the real academic world, even though it's easy to say it should be the case. But in fact, it's not easy for it to be the case. The second, I think, is the international nature of the university, which lets people more easily interact in a way with problems that have global significance. The obverse, of course, is how do you get these things to happen in two different dimensions. I don't believe it will ever win just by logic against emotions. I think that's hopeless. I think you've got to figure out a way to have emotional logic. That is, people who believe in these things and understand these issues have to have a way, perhaps reduced to be active. There has to be a way of communicating. People don't always think that way. Who have real problems that they can't quite work out. They can't quite understand the rationale of all this. And so somehow we have to find a way of getting excited about the data we've got, getting excited about what we know, and being able to communicate that excitement. So it doesn't just look like a talking head on the other side of the conference saying, well, on the TV screen or whatever it is. I think in that way, the first question from Joe Schwartz illustrates one of the possibilities, which is why we have, for example, developed inside the Faculty of Science, the Science and Public Policy area, which he's responsible for. So I think those are some of the things that can make it work here. One final possibility is, I think McGill, and I know I'm biased in this area, but McGill has a way of being able to act locally and internationally at the same time. That's what I took from the panel a few minutes ago. If we just wait for the superordinate people to solve all these problems on a worldwide basis, we'll wait forever. That has its own value. We've got to somehow also work from the bottom up and the top down and see whether we can bring it on. I wouldn't want to think McGill's unique in this respect, but I think it's one of the strengths we bring.
In case you didn't recognize him, this is the principal emeritus of McGill. Thank you very much for those comments. Sitting next to Kathy Flanders, who is a great citizen of Montreal, who received an honorary doctorate last spring for her invention of the minis, starting with MiniMed and proceeding through the other faculties of the university, and providing courses that are accessible to a public that is desperately interested in what is produced here, and then is translated, is transferred as knowledge to the public in terms that they can understand. And so we are engaged at so many levels in this knowledge transfer, and the collaborations that Bernard described are one of the unique distinguishing characteristics of the place.
I just want to add a few things. First, I want to give you a sense of what this inter-faculty piece is about, because I can't tell you how important and how rare it is, I think, unless we walk through an example. You know, at other great universities besides Harvard, so that I'm not just fingering Harvard, I have had the privilege of collaborating with people at top universities around the world, but what it looks like in practice when you're saying I want to work on poverty is you basically need the principal or the president to believe it so much that they ask the dean to really request that one faculty member will spend 10 minutes meeting with you. That's what that looks like at most universities. That is not how we get to solutions on major problems. Okay, what's it look like at McGill? So when we're working on our poverty database, for example, trying to figure out what's going on around the world, we call people to law school. We easily have gotten a half a dozen faculty to come and sit and talk to us about how laws are shaped around the world. I called people at the business school. They said, well, let's do a course together. Let's get the students involved. We had this huge number of students who wanted to volunteer to work on the problem. We got the business students involved. We talked to the ed school. They said, wow, you're having this conference on how educational inequalities puts in. We'd like to do this piece. There is just an enormous eagerness to collaborate on it in ways that touch students, faculty, and every level of the university and transforms it. The second thing I think is unique, and I don't know where it comes from, but I do know how important it is McGill's commitment to impact. I wish I could tell you most universities have that same commitment. But most universities really measure their success by how many articles they put out and how many Nobel laureates, and I know the university is very grateful. We have a couple new ones. But that's how they measure it, and most universities don't measure its high impact. And the amount of value and investment that is placed here that allows all of us to work on spending time on translating things, to work with policymakers, to work with the media, that prizes people who do is extraordinary. And then I think the last thing, building on your comments, is the training piece, is this opportunity that we have, and I've mentioned that already, but there is a flexibility of thinking that I think is fairly unique here in terms of new approaches to training. And whether it's building the school's environment and being across faculty, whether it's building our institute or policy and being across faculty, that ability to innovate rapidly here transforms our training.
Nick, does this answer your question? Nick is an oncologist in Washington, I believe. Right. Do you have some thoughts about answering your question?
Well, I thought the part about the culture that you, I think, you've emphasized. Washington, as you, like any big city, is fairly bureaucratic. And I think that the health system I work in is also very bureaucratic. And what I'm hearing is the professors that are attracted to McGill have think big. And imagine the students, if they don't think that way when they arrive at McGill, because of your influence, begin to think big. And I think it's helpful trying to convince other graduates that live elsewhere that this is a very special place and different. And I think what's emphasized, but not necessarily unique, but we're uncommon.
I think there's another element, too, that's here, and I, like Jody, was at another institution before I came here, spent my first 10 years in another institution, and came here. And one of the things that struck me when I came to McGill, and McGill does talk about excellence, is that people think about excellence in terms of a series of metrics, but I think it's much deeper in that in terms of the culture. Jody raised the issue about the McGill School of Environment. It actually was done under the former principal's watch. And it was done by three deans that got together and actually listened to a number of professors that pitched an idea about looking at how other environment programs and other universities had started out being with all these ambitions of being interdisciplinary and then had become their own entity and separated themselves kind of from the mothership and then became fairly entrenched and lost that large interdisciplinary element. And McGill went on a venture with the School of Environment that I think is really, really unique in the sense, now, as a former director, having done this for 5 years now, I would never advocate the administrative structure that we had at the School of Environment, where I had to answer to four deans. There is a certain dysfunctionality that occurs with doing that. But you also have four very powerful people in the university that have that entity as part of their package to obtaining this kind of excellence. So if you're going to do something at McGill, and I think that you get the people that can help you to do those things buying into it, then the attitude is make it good. Make it as the best possible thing that you can do. And I think that's where real innovation happens, where you take risks to try new structures and do things in different ways and approach it. It's not smooth sailing all the way through, but you have the cheerleaders there that keep supporting you and keeps. And the school last year celebrated its 10th decade, and it's got 300 majors in it, and it offers four degrees for three faculties. It's the first time I've ever seen that ever in a university. The school offers degrees for faculties.
A question here.
I was just going to make a comment in response to your question. My name is Ariane Moralia. I'm from Faculty of Medicine, and I've also had the privilege of spending time at other great universities, including the University of Montreal, UCLA, and Harvard. And I think one of the very interesting things about McGill, and we had this discussion at the Board of the Faculty of Arts, talking about McGill's identity, is that, and it sort of brings me to thinking a little bit about dualities and polar opposites. McGill's mission is very grounded in its identity. We are very much a Quebec institution. We're also very much a Canadian institution. And we've had to define our identity within Quebec, getting very creative about who we are, not just locally, but internationally. And I think it has gone a very long way to sustaining our identity mission. And I think it's very interesting to think about the existence of McGill within Quebec, which is a very, very, very unique place, within Montreal, which is a very, very unique place, within Canada, which is a very unique place. But that constant tension between our survival as a Quebec institution and our outlook onto the rest of the world, I think has gone a very long way to making us unique.
Very interesting perspective. Yes, Gary.
Hi, Gary Peckley. So I'm a pediatrician here as well. I want to pick up on Ariane's point because I think it's pretty important. Often we bemoan some of the particular challenges we have here in terms of an underfunded environment, et cetera. But I agree absolutely. Having wended my way back into Canada via Houston and Chicago and back to here, that some of the challenges and opportunities of being, and I take Principal Shapiro's admonition about overuse of the word unique, within a North American context, some of the challenges and opportunities we face here, being an English-speaking university within a French-speaking milieu, are unique. And I think they've uniquely given us some strength. If we have an Anglophone principal who's managed to take leadership of all leaders, academic leaders, within Quebec, that took not just generic skills, but some specificity of negotiating in what is almost an international setting, so that once you've mastered it within Quebec, hey, the rest of the world is a piece of cake. Say that a bit facetiously, but not totally. So it means that we start the locality of our challenges and our opportunities really are almost international in their nature. So it just makes it that much easier for us to have a breadth of perspective in terms of our role within the world, with interacting more easily with colleagues as I do in Francophone Africa or wherever it is. So there's some particular strengths that we have developed because of some of the particular challenges and opportunities of being where we are. And I think also, in terms of our ability to attract faculty who are looking at any number of, deprecating, but pretty standard issue places of excellence, say across North America, you've got to have something special about you in terms of the things that motivate you to say, I'm going to take on this additional hassle of coming here and working within this place. So that I think reflects on some of the excellence and unique features, pardon me, of some of our faculty and some of the students who are attracted here. In my own domain, there's no question, having worked with postgraduate residents in pediatrics in any number of places across North America, the Americans that I'm able to attract here march to a slightly different tune because there needed to be something about coming to this place which is somewhat different from the other options they're looking at. That makes them special and helps us to be even better than we otherwise might be.
Yeah, there was a question in the back. Please.
Let's go back to the health reading and the well-being in the world. It seems to me that you said a couple of times you used the word scientific community or whatever. And Dr. Schwartz has been leading our catch-up ever since I left McGill. And my question is, what can we do to make sure that every student who leaves McGill has a thorough grounding no matter what faculty they're in, has a thorough grounding in what I would call basic science. And then, based on what Dr. Shapiro's brother said last night when we were talking about our intake, our admissions, maybe if we were fussier about our intake, and make sure that the people, the students that come in as undergraduates, have as much knowledge of general science as they do of 18th century poetry. And as an art student myself, I don't want to denigrate the arts, and I don't want to denigrate literature, but it seems to me we're way out of whack. I left McGill with a perfectly decent degree with one science course in 60. And it was a basic course that taught you a little bit about everything. I got into McGill with one science course, basic, what I would call physical physics. And it was very good, and I passed it, and I passed it well. But my knowledge of science has been catch up ever since. And when you look at the global problems, even if you look at local problems, the dispute over whether we're going to be inoculated or not, it's extraordinary the level of ignorance of science. And unless we attack the level of ignorance of science, basic science, we're never ever going to get the world on the wheel for improving things.
Thank you. Would you introduce yourself to the audience?
Oh, I'm Joan Ivory. And I'm a graduate.
Who would like to tackle that one?
Well, I can start on that in the sense that this is one thing that we have to think about very seriously about admission when we form the school. There's not many professors that actually have an opportunity in a very well-established university to start with an entire program from the ground up and say, okay, what is it we want to do? In that case, we did have requirements both from certain elements of science and certain elements of social science to come in, which has created a student that I'm not sure they know what they're in for when they come. They have this notion that they want to do this across both. But I teach in the large introductory science course that's in that program, which every single student, so half the students are in the school are actually doing a Bachelor's of Arts program, have to take that course. They perform just as well as the science student does in that course, partly because they tend to write better, and their communication skills are better, and some of their analytical ability in being able to think broadly over issues. They're not quite reductionist in their thinking. But that actually presents some serious challenges, because when you start looking at that, you are creating a program that is very much out of sync with the entire system that is feeding students to the universities. The students that come to universities come out of high schools or CEGEP, and unless that level is in sync between it, you can't start putting demands on those students that mean that they have a 5-year gap in their education program. I actually agree with you halfway in the sense I do believe that we need to work on scientific literacy, but I also believe that I'm one of these people that was able to go through my science program at university with virtually no humanities or arts courses. And I would say that I was just very fortunate that my father suggested to me on a whim when I was needing to pick up another credit, he said, well, why don't you take a course in philosophy? So I went and took a course in philosophy and ended up getting a minor in philosophy while doing a double major. And I think in many ways, my perspective of looking at things, it's actually those things that you do outside that broaden the way to do it. But it's bringing people in. We have a structure that we've got to work on below the universities to deal with that also.
I wonder if we could hear from our wonderful dean of music, a school which is as scientifically oriented in the understanding of the human response to music as any place in the world. Don, do you have a response to that question?
I very carefully place people in the audience. It's notable that Bernard spoke immediately to the emotional impact, and Joe's argument very powerful for standing up to the foes of science in this sense. The reason it works here, because all three of the people in Rich himself have that emotional grasp of the data and know how to communicate it, know how to express it in ways that are compelling to people. We will always have to have that mixture of knowing the data and being able to present it in a passionate way. Now, speaking of music itself, we're in a very unusual situation. As Rich has said, people know that we have scientific leadership in music in the neuroscience area, and as well as one of the top 10 schools in the world, supposedly, as music schools generally in terms of training musicians. For us, it's really interesting to see the kind of people that come. We have a lot of people who are not successful in the narrowness of musical training at some point in their career. They're at Juilliard School at 15 years old. They leave. They come back here. They end up coming to McGill because of the environment that people are talking about, the interdisciplinary environment, the collegial environment among the students that challenge each other. I have a rather uncompetitive music school. Most music schools are pretty cutthroat. But in our case, we have a situation where people want to come because of the ensemble activity, because of the way they work together as a team, which become models for other faculties as well. The last point I want to say is, I give an example of that. We have a person who went to Juilliard, didn't enjoy the experience, came back, won our Golden Violin Award, and did a double degree in environmental science and music. And so we see those people. I would like to say, however, it's not quite as easy as people think, at least in the initial stages. When I first approached other faculties about what we were doing in music and how we should interact together with engineering and science and other areas, the initial response was pushback. What I actually had to do is take advantage of a visionary moment where we were building staff and we were expanding resources to go and hire my own physicists, electrical engineers, computer scientists, respirologists, neurologists, etc., who all worked on music. After that core was established, then it became possible to do what people are describing and go to the engineering faculty and the science faculty and build a leveraged environment. So, you know, you do have to have moments and opportunities to step out of these things, and you obviously have to be passionate about the data that you present.
You know, the structural issue that's been raised by Nigel and Don and others is critical. And the question is, does the structure, the academic organization of universities, actually support the kind of innovation that is, I would say, commonplace at McGill, but at a great cost to the system and the individual who is trying to move it? Maybe that's a statement about innovation anywhere, but, you know, we still ask departments to mentor and manage the professorial life cycle. You are in a department of biology or English, and you will rise in the ranks and receive tenure based on your performance as defined by your department within your school, within your university. And yet many of the things that we are talking about as solutions require knowledge and wisdom that is spread, as Jody described, across 5 faculties. How do we change our place in order to recognize a new kind of scholarship, a new kind of excellence, which is a very risky venture when you're a young assistant professor starting out, expecting to advance and wandering into an area that combines things that previously couldn't be combined. We are convinced in the life sciences that the combination of chemistry, physics, computer science, mathematics with biology will be a means by which, at the end of this century of biology, we will have conquered a lot of the chronic illnesses. But it will take the collaboration of unique groups. And how does everyone in each group get appropriate credit for the contribution that each has made? So it's a major issue for the university in trying to answer Ms. Ivory's question.
Can I follow up on that 1 second? I think it also has to do with the importance of the fact that we do have private as well as public sources of funding, whether those private sources are foundation funding or where those private sources are individuals. The public funding tends to be very unidisciplinary. You know, Quebec, like many provinces, like many countries, does very well for people who stay within a department. That's not unique to here. In the United States, where most of our funding in medical schools is from the NIH, they do very well for cardiovascular disease, narrow. Cancer, narrow. They don't do very well for these big social issues. They don't have a great way to address poverty, which spans areas, to address environment, which spans areas, or even to go beyond the vaccine development and actually make sure it goes to delivery, because that spans from biology to policy. These are our areas of greatest innovation. These are, I think, McGill's unique strength in many ways. It has outstanding excellence, but there are other top universities. But this ability to take on the big issues effectively. But that very much is something that requires both public and private support.
Maybe a last question or observation. Yes, in the middle of the back.
Good morning. We have case experience from the Institute of Parasitology and working on ABC transporters. Having heard your comment on the H1N1 virus and the vaccine, I would like to put forward a question, if you can allow me, please. So my question is, we have seen already in the field of molecular biology for cancer the problem of multi-drug resistance. And we know the reason that the inadvertent use of antibiotics has led to this problem. Having seen that, that's from the therapeutic point of view. But now, when we talk about a vaccine, it's from the prophylactic point of view. Moreover, to my knowledge, H1N1 virus is not a virus on its own. It has emerged due to the genetic recombination of the virus that infects humans with that of this one. How sure we are at this point that another mutation might not happen in the future to the existing virus, nor that when we take a new vaccine for each and every emerging situation like this in the future, that we are killing our native innate immunity?
I guess this one comes to me.
Very briefly, the common misconception is that any influenza virus is a single entity. Influenza viruses, of which there are many, mutate very rapidly because they are RNA viruses and they do not have the standard correction systems that we have for our DNA. So, when a mistake is made in the producing of a virus, the mutation just stays in all of the subsequent viruses. This virus also has essentially 8 little chromosomes, or this family of viruses, they all have 8 little chromosomes that can segregate independently. That's a very complicated term for the simple statement that if you take one cell and put 2 viruses of different origin into the same cell, in fact, the viral progeny that come out of that single cell can be any viable combination of the 8 type A virus and the 8 type B viruses that went in. So that, in fact, the viruses are remarkably plastic. They also mutate under pressure. They mutate under pressure from antibodies that we form in our bodies when we've been infected. So I was one of the lucky few in the June wave of the H1N1 to get the virus. So I had my H1N1, which has all of my colleagues looking at me now going, oh goody, you can cover for me when I get sick. I plan to be away for several months. So in fact, these viruses mutate as a natural part of their biology. And in fact, that's called genetic drift when they mutate at individual spots, and genetic shift when they accept wholesale one of the chromosomes from another species. In fact, the H1N1 family of viruses that we're looking at now originated from part bird, part pig, part human. So in fact, it's a mutt virus that we've never seen before. That being said, it's not really all that different from other viruses. It is actively mutating. It mutated in the southern hemisphere. It's now mutating as it's coming back towards us. And as many of us become infected, it will mutate further under the pressure of the antibodies that we mount, whether we mount those antibodies in response to the vaccine or natural infection. So the real question is not whether we should vaccinate or not, but can we use the new tools that we have to develop a vaccine that will cover more than 1 year's worth of influenza viruses? Can we be cleverer than we are now and generate a next generation of vaccines that will allow us to be vaccinated once every 5 years, or once every 10 years, or maybe once for life, as we do for hepatitis B and some of the other illnesses? So, there's no reason to fear the vaccination program, because it will elicit antibodies that will cause the virus to mutate. It's going to mutate whether we give vaccine or get the disease.
We'll give Jody the last word.
This question, which for those of you in the audience who, following the earlier question, actually either arrived at McGill without science or left McGill without science, and maybe has you thinking that this particular question is not relevant to you, it's not the way you think about it, is actually a wonderful question that in many ways does span all three areas. So I just want to mention one project to make that concrete. We have a collaborative project on drug resistance of another organism, of tuberculosis, which kills millions each year and has been one of the major killers for centuries in the world. And in Peru, where we're working, who's more likely to get the drug resistant strain? It has to do with where you live and where you work. And who's spreading it to more people as it's rapidly spreading? It's the people who are living in these settings with the most people in the smallest number of bedrooms, who are working in locations where they are in marketplaces, exposing hundreds of others. It's exactly the kind of problem that actually going from the biologic basis to the social has immense strength. We have a new initiative there in Peru, which makes the last tie, which is actually looking at climate change and water temperature change and how that is transforming what kind of disease burden that is. So I just want to end by saying I do think each of these problems, whether we start with infection or start with environment or start with poverty, connects deeply to the others. We're thrilled to be working on it, and I think I speak for all of us to say we know how many partners we need. We know that in the audience there are other scientists, there are people working in the private sector, in the public sector, who have a lot to teach us, who have a lot to bring to these kind of problems. So I hope you're going to work with us on it.
So we started with an impossible mandate, healing our world. And we had, I think, a wonderful conversation that took us from biology and the molecular to the social. And we realized in the course of this conversation that healing our world requires that we focus locally as well as globally, that we have changes to make in how we are organized to do science and scholarship. We have new collaborations to encourage. And we heard something about the capacity of McGill, which I think we can conclude on the basis of this conversation, is as relevant to the century of biology as it was in the two prior centuries of its existence. A very far-reaching and interesting conversation in which we will remember John Donne's words that we need not ask for whom the bell tolls. Thank you very much. And
And we have little tokens to thank our wonderful panelists for their contributions and their excitement for us this morning. Thank you.